Hello, I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the program. On the Religion and Ethics Report today, a new report from the aid agency Save the Children documents life under siege in Syria. From malnutrition to stuttering, the suffering of children is intense. And have our comedians become preachers, not challenging the dominant culture, but scoring easy points? A Christian minister wants them to offend us. We start, though, with the self-styled Islamic State group's attack on the Belgian capital, Brussels. Every Islamist attack on Europe tests and possibly weakens the European Union and its policy of free movement across the continent. The terrorist incidents also highlight the problem of integrating some parts of Europe's Muslim community. Professor Fethi Mansouri is director of the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalization at Deakin University. He's also the author of Muslims in the West and the Challenges of Belonging, and he's an international expert on integration, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
As we reflect on these latest attacks in Europe, in Brussels in particular, can I read to you the words of Adam Nossiter in the New York Times, where he said the attacks had set off a new round of soul searching on whether such attacks have become an unavoidable part of life in an open European society. You know this situation very well. What's the answer to that question?
I would maybe take that statement a step further, and I would say that some of these attacks are probably becoming much more normalized, not only in Europe or in North America, but across a wide spectrum of societies in North Africa and the Middle East. And let's just remind ourselves and the listeners that it was only 2 weeks ago that we had a major incursion into southern Tunisia, the southern city of Benghadan, which is bordering on Libya, that also we had since attacks in Istanbul in Turkey, and that before that we had similar attacks in Bamako in West Africa. And yes, we are seeing right now the ugly face of terrorism in Europe, at the heart of Europe, in Brussels. So in many ways, perhaps we are normalizing these terrible atrocities, these senseless acts of terrorism, not only within pure European Western urban localities, but also across a number of countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia and beyond.
Professor, there's also been a lot of attention on the fact that Brussels is at the heart of the European project. I mean, it is the capital of the European Union, or one of them. It is certainly the place where the European Union is anchored. What do we read into that? Is it indeed an Islamist attack on the European project?
I'm not sure that we can read too much into the symbolism of choosing Brussels, but let's not forget also that Belgium is perhaps, in terms of per capita representation, is probably the highest country in Europe which has sent jihadis to join IS in Syria and Iraq. There are some really deep problems in Belgium in relation to integrating second-generation migrants of North African background in particular. And in my view, Belgium is a very good case in point, because there is a plethora of reasons of why Belgium has been attacked. Yes, Belgium has a lot of jihadis who have joined ISIS, and as I said earlier, very high in proportional terms. Yes, Belgium has had some problems integrating a number of its minority groups, in particular second-generation Maghrebi youth. And also, yes, Belgium is also the headquarters, so to speak, of the European Union. So it has the EU, the EC, and also NATO as the headquarters who are located in Belgium. It may well be that a combination of all of the above have perhaps led to this particular event taking place in Brussels.
You put your finger on what many believe to be the root of the problem, and that is the failure of the Belgian integration model. I mean, this is the area of your expertise for which you're internationally recognised. What is Belgium's problem specifically, its specific failure to integrate there?
I think in general terms, and a lot of my research in Europe has probably focused more on France and the UK than perhaps Belgium, but you can see there are a lot of similarities between southern France and parts of Belgium, and in particular the Molenbeek area, which is known for its high density in relation to Muslim, in particular Moroccan populations. And what you see perhaps being in common across Western Europe in relation to the integration of second-generation Muslim migrants in particular. And I've interviewed many young Europeans of Muslim background, and I've interviewed a lot of imams and religious leaders also in those areas where there's high density of Muslims. And really, the picture that we can paint is one of deep sense of alienation among youth. There's a shrinking possibilities for them, both in terms of educational outcomes, but also in terms of accessing the labor market. The housing segregated areas are extremely substandard. To add to that mix is the fragmented leadership in the community. This is where perhaps Belgium differs a little bit from France. We all know that Belgium had had perhaps historical contacts with radical Salafis from the peninsula, from the Arabian Peninsula. And I think they took roots in Belgium, and I think that's what produced perhaps a new version of emigre Islam in Belgium, which is more conservative, more radical. And now we are finding out it's becoming also slightly more violent. People have known about this, and people have alerted through research that this needs to be a top priority in Belgian policy-making circles. But unfortunately, the emphasis, all the emphasis, has been on law enforcement and much less on social integration.
I notice that the New York Times also suggested that Belgium was perhaps the world's wealthiest failed state, because it said that there was a worrying mix of deeply rooted terrorist networks. How do terrorist networks root themselves in a country like Belgium and in a neighbourhood like Molenbeek of Brussels?
What we know from some of the sociological research that we do is that nowadays it's not very difficult for radical, violent organizations, the likes of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, to be able to penetrate any society they really want to penetrate because of the prevalence of social media and because of the capacity they have developed in utilizing social media to develop those narratives through which they can hire and even train, in some cases, local recruits. So we know that's happening, but the problem and the question I would like us to focus more on is what conditions do we have locally which would perhaps produce young people who are really easily targeted by the IS message and the IS narrative? And why do we allow our schools and our local organizations and our local leadership structures to produce failed policies, which therefore are tapped into by the likes of IS and Al-Qaeda before them.
And just on that point, Professor Mansouri, Oxford University research suggests that the greatest danger as far as the radicalization of young Muslims comes not from the mosque, but from family and social connections. What does your research suggest?
Again, the extensive research that was done in Southern Europe in particular, but also in America and in other places, in Australia too, suggests that, yes, the family is always the starting unit where problems can be detected. But in a lot of the research that we did, it's what happens when young people are outside of the family unit. So what happens to them when they go to school or fail to stay in schools, or what happens to them when they start frequenting places of worship. And I think the leadership of some of those units, be it a local club or a mosque, or I think is extremely important in protecting and shielding young people from the dangerous messages that they might be exposed to through social media, coming as they are from IS sources. So I think, yes, family is very important, and we know this, but even more important is the role of people who handle and deal with young people in educational settings, in spiritual religious settings, and even in service provision areas and agencies.
Professor Fethi Mansouri, Director of the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalization at Deakin University, the author of Muslims in the West and the Challenges of Belonging and the Global Perspectives on the Politics of Multiculturalism. Professor Mansouri, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Up to 2 million people are under siege in Syria, about a third of them children. That's according to a new report from the aid group Save the Children. It comes just weeks after the United Nations heard that children were affected disproportionately by violence in the Middle East and Africa. Save the Children is warning of a traumatic long-term impact on young victims. Its Director of Policy and Public Affairs is Matt Tinkler, and he says the violence against Syria's children is the worst since World War II.
The conflict in Syria has now raged for 5 years. Some 13 million people have been displaced either internally or have moved out of Syria in search of safety. Inside Syria at the moment, we estimate that there's 500,000 people trapped in besieged cities, literally cut off from virtually all forms of aid and support. And that's resulting in people dying and children dying from things that they shouldn't.
Now, the notion of being besieged, in this case, it appears to violate all norms of warfare because not even basic medical supplies are getting through.
That's right. These cities and the people within them are essentially being used as a weapon of war by multiple parties to this conflict. They take over a city, they prevent people from leaving, people are shot if they leave the city boundaries, they prevent access to aid organisations so aid convoys can't get through, they won't let people have access to medical treatment that can save lives. So there's around a dozen cities that we would say satisfy that definition of besieged, and yeah, that leaves 500,000 people essentially in open-air prisons inside Syria at the moment.
I mean, you're being cautious there in a sense, Matt, when you refer to 500,000 people, because as you say, your own report suggests it could be somewhere between 487,000 people, but also Médecins Sans Frontières estimates up to 1.9 million people. I guess it goes to the difficulty of getting an accurate figure in such a war-torn zone.
That's right. It's hard to get accurate figures on anything inside Syria at the moment. Save the Children, for example, isn't able to program directly inside that country. We have to rely on partner organisations. So we use around a dozen non-government organisations that are inside Syria to help deliver our support and aid. But that means it's less reliable in terms of the data we can access. So these are estimates. But on any calculation, the numbers are quite staggering. And the human toll of this conflict is just overwhelming.
And when we talk about the groups and the people laying siege to these towns, besieging somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million people, who are the perpetrators?
Well, it's all parties to this conflict, unfortunately. So, as I said, these cities essentially become a weapon of war, and it's a strategic advantage for one armed group to hold a city over another. So that's both the government forces inside Syria, the rebels, forces from ISIS and others. Everyone is doing this, and yeah, it's unfortunately the children and the people of Syria that are paying the toll.
Let's talk specifically about some of the tolls that these children are paying. What is the situation regarding nutrition?
It's a dire situation. So food supplies have dwindled. The food that is available is extraordinarily highly priced because of inflation. We've heard stories of children dying from starvation and malnutrition. We've heard stories of children dying in their mother's arms at a checkpoint, trying to access medical attention just on the other side of that checkpoint, but not being allowed through. So it's a life or death situation right now for these people trapped in these towns.
You point out that in parts of northern Homs, the price of a bundle of bread is 900% higher than what it is just a few kilometres away.
That's right, and that's when we have to be very careful around how aid is delivered and distributed. And there was an attempt not long ago to deliver aid to some of these cities by airdrop, and that didn't go so well because much of the food aid was captured by armed groups and then used again as a weapon of war. Effectively, they distribute that aid to the communities they want to and hold off from others and force people to play these inflationary prices. The ceasefire that has been in place, or the cessation of hostilities for the last few weeks, has helped a little bit. So we have started to see the first convoys get through to some of these towns, but it hasn't been unfettered access. Supplies have been removed from convoys, and it's selective in terms of which convoys get through to which town. So there's people who are still cut off and really struggling.
Yeah, and what really struck me was that often, as your report illustrates, food is tantalisingly close. It's stored in warehouses, and yet because of the war, it can't make the last 5 or 10 kilometres. It's extraordinary.
That's right. And you know, people are being cut off through checkpoints, and it is, as you say, tantalisingly close, a kilometre or several hundred metres away from the border of these cities where there's a warehouse with food inside. And you can imagine if you're in that scenario how desperate you would be to access that food for your family. So people turn to desperate measures.
Now, you say that this recent ceasefire is seeing some aid and assistance get through. When those aid workers, including from Save the Children Fund and its partner organisations, arrive in some of these towns, just outline for us the conditions in which they will find some of the children particularly, because, you know, it's very sobering what you write in this report.
It is, and it's a very confronting scene when you come into this town and you see people who've been cut off for months or longer. We're seeing malnutrition being pervasive among children, so things like stunting, where children are way shorter than they should be for their age, wasting, you know, that emaciated look that people get when they haven't been adequately nourished, and people are desperate for food. So it's very confronting, and it's just vital that we continue to put pressure on all parties to this conflict to allow aid through so we can support those who are most vulnerable.
It's not just the physical symptoms, though. What are psychologists and psychiatrists who work for aid organisations who partner with Save the Children telling us about the emotional turmoil that this is causing for children in particular?
It's very difficult for a child to live in an environment that's characterised by fear and conflict. They've seen things that children shouldn't see. They are forced to leave their home environment, so they're in a new and strange place. Often they're separated from families or they lose family members, so quite often they might be alone in the world. So in that scenario, the psychological, psychosocial impacts on children are profound, and that manifests itself in a range of ways, from things like bedwetting to withdrawal to aggression to depression, and it can have a real lasting impact on the life of that child, which is why it's so important that we support in the best way possible. That's by providing psychosocial support, by providing areas where children can play and be children, by getting children into early childhood education, kindergarten, and into school ultimately. The sooner we can bring back a sense of normality and routine into the lives of these children and provide them with those supports, the sooner that they will recover and be able to get on with their lives.
Just as we wind up, Matt, how does what's happening in Syria fit into a broader arc of violence against children? Because Save the Children, I think, is also in Afghanistan, for example, and Pakistan.
We are, and we've seen in recent years a disturbing trend towards attacks on schools and education facilities. So the Peshawar attack in Pakistan, and indeed inside Syria at the moment, many school buildings are being bombed and destroyed by all sides to this conflict. And again, this is a really profound impact on a generation of people, where not only will they have an acute shortage of their education needs being met, but longer term it will take years, if not decades, to rebuild that infrastructure. And we know that this is the most important thing in terms of setting children on the right path, making them resilient, giving them the means for economic progress and opportunity, and preventing that extremism that can be bred out of instability and conflict.
Matt Tinkler of Save the Children, and I'm Andrew West with the Religion and Ethics Report on RN and online. Well, are our comedians dissidents or just preachers running the establishment line? In the US in the 1950s and 60s, Dick Gregory and George Carlin made themselves heroically unpopular with comedy that offended the conservative white majority. But writer and Anglican minister Michael Jensen says Australia's comedians have become moralisers for the new liberal majority. On the ABC's Drum website, he got a huge reaction when he said comics were hitting easy targets. So what does Michael Jensen want from comedy?
Comedy, it's been known for a long time, has this moral thing going for it. It's what it does best. But I've noticed it in recent times that actually the comics that we have paraded in front of us on the telly, they choose safe targets. It seems to me that their moralism is becoming more evident and their comedy, unfortunately, is receding into the background as they go.
And you think what? That is, I guess, stepping back from the traditional courageous role of comedy. Sometimes it was offensive, but very often comics, especially in the 1950s and 60s in America, were what, a bit more brave?
Definitely. So I think the problem is that they're not offensive enough, and yet the persona that's given off is one of being the naughty boy, being the scallywag. There's not enough of the scallywag, not enough of the court jester about today's comics. They attack things, but they do so actually from a fairly safe position. It's all very predictable what they attack. Their audience isn't challenged by what they hear. I reckon a great comic is one that leaves you feeling completely uncomfortable. You laugh, but then you don't know if you're supposed to be laughing at yourself or not.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of Charlie Pickering. He's one of the people that you've mentioned in your piece for The Drum.
The only way that gay people are like North Korea is that despite being oppressed, they sure know how to throw a great pride march. Corey Bernardi didn't know what we're all worried about. We already have a solution for bullied LGBTI teens.
We've always had a system, and it's called parents, it's called teachers, it's called, you know, chaplains.
Sending gay kids to the chaplain makes as much sense as, I don't know, sending Corey Bernardi to the United Nations. But when our public figures speak like this, it gets much worse at ground level, as journalist Jill Stark found out when she wrote in defence of safe schools and received this response, quote, "This is how poofters and dykes bringing vulnerable children into their unnatural and perverted way of life. There is a movement to make out poofarism is normal, same as the Medibank." Yours truly, Dennis from the Sun State Property Group. And yes, he really put his name and company logo there. Now, while it's easy to dismiss this, and don't get me started on the Medibank, this attitude is real and it's out there.
Now, Michael, you heard Charlie Pickering there. I mean, he was certainly playing to his crowd. It was obviously an agreeable crowd, but boy, he had some good material to work with.
I wouldn't doubt that. And Charlie's got every right to have his opinion and to express it, so he should. But let's not pretend he's doing something brave or something particularly clever by doing so. He's really picked the low-hanging fruit here. There are feminists who are opposed to the program he's talking about. Now, that's interesting. Why are there people on his left, as well as people on his right, who are opposed? There are sophisticated people, educationalists, who have looked at the material and have questions to ask. So why not take them on? I mean, it's easy to talk about Corey Bernardi. There's a kind of clumsiness to those people. There was the clumsiness of the guy who wrote that little letter. That wasn't particularly clever to point that out. And also, there's a sense in which this is a very easy thing to do. Corey Bernardi's and his supporters are not going to be watching this particular show. There's no challenge to anyone's point of view here. This is just kind of getting the gang together and chucking stones.
It does strike me that in an awful lot of this satire and comedy, there is a real elitism.
Yes, that's true. So what I think has happened is that the comedy is now coming from the centre, not from the margins. The comedian loves to think of himself as on the edge, but if you've got a television show and you've been on it for years and years and years and you wear a suit and you sit behind a desk, it looks like you're coming from the centre, not from the fringes. And so, yeah, what happens is you have this sort of isolating function. I don't want to blame that kind of comedian for the rise of a Donald Trump, for instance. People who vote for Trump, they're responsible adults and they should take a good look at themselves, frankly. But the ridicule heaped on Trump and the ridicule heaped on those who would vote for him has an isolating function. It really makes people feel alienated.
You also write, this is Pickering's stock in trade. Let's not pretend he's doing anything less than scolding us and preaching to us. He's a self-appointed prophet of liberal pieties. What are some of those liberal pieties?
Right. Well, I think the dominant ideology of our culture at the moment is the thing I would call secular Western liberalism. It is mostly anti-religious, which I'm particularly sensitive to as a minister, of course. It pretends that it mediates between different groups, but it has a strong set of values that it holds in tension. And often these values are in tension, particularly the value of freedom, the value of equality. It kind of has this sort of internal argument between those two. It's dominant in the sense that on issues of marriage redefinition, which it would strongly support, all the media outlets, most of the big companies in Australia have kind of come out and said that that's what it is. And so it has a sort of censorious nature to it. I want to point out that it is an ideology, that it has its own convictions about what is right and what is wrong. wrong. Also, its inability to see and understand and diagnose the convictions of those who oppose it. So what happens when people from a more conservative point of view, or even from the socialist end actually, stand up and say things, in the secular liberal middle, we don't understand how you could come to those sorts of positions.
And of course, the other thing is, and you point this out in your piece, it's easy to get a laugh with some of the easiest and sort of crudest measures by calling people a dick.
Well, yes, I'm afraid Adam Hills, who's he can be pretty good on his day. He's got this show in England called The Last Leg. He turns his bile at people who just wouldn't be watching the show and calls them dicks, and has a competition called the Dick of the Year.
I have four simple words, people. Don't be a dick. If you're a counsellor that said disabled children should be put down, you're being a dick, and we will not talk about you anymore on this show. If you make fat jokes about Adele, you're being a dick. And I'm referring to you, Joan Rivers.
I watch it because I liked Adam Hills before, but it's just become so preachy. I mean, there's nothing else to say about it. It really is. There's a social vision he's got and he's preaching it. So why not just come out and say that?
Just finally, Michael, you do say of these comedians, these aren't naughty boys. They are would-be messiahs, obviously a sort of homage to Monty Python. I gather you weren't one of the Christians who was offended by the life of Brian. Indeed, you think that was what the kind of satire that you really think is effective?
Definitely. I mean, one of the most effective anti-religious satirical books in human history is the Bible. One of the most adamant critics of religion and of religious hypocrisy was, of course, Jesus Christ. I think the Monty Pythons were kind of doing us a favour there because they were exposing human gullibility and the way we follow around after anyone who kind of makes some grand claim. I think there was a great insight into human nature.
Did you say ex-leper?
That's right, sir. 16 years behind a bell. I'm proud of you, sir.
Well, what happened?
Oh, cured, sir.
Cured?
Yes, some bloody miracle, sir.
Who cured you?
Jesus did, sir. I was hopping along, minding my own business. All of a sudden, up he comes, cures me. One minute I'm a leper with a trade, next minute my livelihood's gone. Not so much as a by your leave.
You're cured, mate. Bloody do-gooder.
Well, why don't you go and tell him that you want to be a leper again?
Oh, I could do that, sir, yeah.
Yeah, I could do that, I suppose.
What I was thinking, I was going to ask him if he'd make me a bit lame in one leg during the middle of the week. You know, something beggable, but not leprosy, which is a pain in the ass, to be blunt. Excuse my French, sir, but...
Brian, come and clean your room out!
There are.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Half a denarii for me bloody life story.
There's no pleasing some people.
That's just what Jesus said, sir.
Maybe their intention was to satirise all religion, but actually I think they cleared a good space for us there to have a proper conversation about religious truth and about belief. They certainly turned the heat on some very contemporary issues that are going on today.
And I think that satire will endure for many decades. Dr. Michael Jensen is the rector of St. Mark's Anglican Church in Darling Point. He's a prolific author, a regular columnist with the ABC's Drum website. Thanks for being with us, Michael, on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrew.
And that is where we leave the program. Now, we had wanted to bring you an extract of the annual Wesley Mission Easter conversation this year between the Reverend Keith Garner and former New South Wales Governor Marie Bashir. Brussels intervened, but there's a full recording at our website where you can also download and share our stories. My thanks to producer Nadia El-Ghouli and technical producer Michelle Watts. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.